Just last week, I got the chance to walk around in Paris, where people were still trying to make sense of what had happened there. Some people chose to stay home, others were out Christmas shopping, and everything was on a spectrum of how to return to normal and how to choose to do that. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This week, we have a lot of stories about choices. We didn't start out that way, but I noticed it as we were putting the show together. Financial choices we wish we could make but can't. How we choose to respond to disaster. Government choices about redesigning a city to make it a little safer. And you can always choose, yeah, to come talk to us at MarketplaceWeekend.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. I mentioned the choices we make with our money and what we do and sometimes don't do or can't do. And last week, we asked you, have you ever wanted to help someone out financially but couldn't? One response came from Rebecca Copeland. She's a 59-year-old professor in St. Louis, and she heard us while listening to KWMU. I asked her to tell me her story.
This is something that happened a little while ago, but I've always felt that I should have tried harder to do more. There was a man who worked in the building where I have my office. It's at a university. He was on the custodial staff and a very kind, courteous person, not very outspoken, but occasionally we'd have an opportunity to just chat a little bit when he'd stop by my office. And I learned some things about him, that he had three children who seemed to be very successful. He'd put them through school, you know, so we just talked a little bit about life and some of the issues that he faced. And then I learned that he had difficulty seeing and his eyesight was growing progressively worse. He put off the scheduled surgery that he had so that he could schedule it at a time that would have the least amount of impact on his work. But the surgery didn't go very well. After the surgery, he had to remain bedridden and took, I guess, maybe about 2 months. And in the meantime, he maxed out his disability and he lost his job. You know, I just felt so frustrated that that had happened to him and wanted to do something, so I took up a collection with amongst my colleagues. But it was just really a token. You know, it wasn't enough to actually stem the problems that he was facing. I felt uncomfortable about, I felt I might have been overstepping my bounds and just never followed through. So that's my story.
Did you have a moment where you thought, oh, maybe he won't want my help?
Yes.
Did you ever talk to him about it?
No. I mean, I don't even know his last name, you know, so I feel like an outsider to the situation. And since that time, he has come back. He hasn't come back to work. I think he's still unemployed, but he has stopped by the building just to greet his the friends that he made here. So I did get a chance to give him a hug.
We also heard from a lot of parents who wanted to help out their kids. Sharon Hannock lives in Orlando and heard our question on WMFE. She's 58 and semi-retired. Last year, her son's girlfriend died suddenly. And Sharon wanted to help him finish a video game project that he and his girlfriend had been working on together, but she didn't have the money.
I wanted to help him and I couldn't. And I just will never forget that feeling. And there was a lesson to be learned through the whole thing for me as well when we went through all of this.
What was the lesson?
I was kind of satisfied with, you know, just hanging out and having an income that just covers everything, just covers, you know, what I need. And it just kind of reminded me, I need to have a little extra just in case there's somebody else or some need that may come up, especially for someone else, that I can be there, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine how hard it was to watch your son want to do something that was clearly so important to him.
Yeah. Yeah, it was his dream, and it was hard to get that funded. Yeah.
So when you think about how this has changed you, do you feel like, you know, now you're trying to kind of have a financial cushion in your life so that you could help him or help someone else if something terrible happens again?
You know, that's the big thing, and it isn't even so much something terrible. It's just, you know, my focus has been on myself and covering, you know, what I need. But it just kind of opened my eyes to just have that little extra, just in case there's a need. It could be something terrible. It could be something good. You know, when you really think about it, this was something good. This was his and her dream. Yeah.
Next week, we want your holiday stories. And no, not the touching ones. I want to know, what's the worst gift you've ever given or gotten? You know, the thing that just fell flat? Come tell us at MarketplaceWeekend.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. Or you can call us at 1-800-648-5114. Now we're going to make some smart people go on the record with stories in the news that they are long or short, in the same way that stock pickers make bets on different equities. This week, we've got Marketplace's Washington Bureau Chief Dave Shaw and Rana Faruhar, a columnist and assistant managing editor at Time Magazine. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hello.
Rana, I will give you the guest prerogative first. What are you long?
I am long an interest rate hike.
I think
what a surprise. What a surprise. But, you know, it's interesting to think about it. I mean, there is basically a 98% chance that the Fed is going to hike rates when it meets next. But why is it hiking rates? That's the question that interests me. You know, a lot of people say that there is a bubble in the market right now, that stocks are not reflecting the reality on the ground. The U.S. recovery has been strengthening.
Yeah.
But let's face the fact, it's still the longest, weakest recovery on record and doesn't really feel like the kind of recovery we would expect by now. That said, I think the Fed feels that they have no choice but to start hiking
at this
point.
Well, they're kind of boxed in, right?
They're very boxed in. Now, the question is, what's going to happen when the Fed is hiking and the rest of the world is actually still easing monetary policy? Then you've got something called the Great Divergence, which I think is actually going to really rock markets at various points in the year ahead.
Well, person in Washington who is in charge of how we're covering all of that stuff, do you agree?
You know, I sometimes wonder if they wished they had raised rates earlier in the year, maybe back in September, and that maybe would have given a little wiggle room now, as opposed to really, as you said, kind of feeling boxed in that everyone truly expects a decision next week.
So, Dave, what are you long?
Well, you know, it's been a topsy-turvy political week. That's putting it nicely.
No kidding.
I am long on voting, which is to say I'm longing for voting. There's a phrase that is attributed to Thomas Paine, voting is the beating heart of our democracy. I am ready to get to some voters. 50-some-odd days away, I think we are, from the Iowa caucuses, February 1st, followed quickly by the New Hampshire primary, followed quickly by the South Carolina primary. I cannot wait for those to be here. So we can actually see, are all the crazy things that we're seeing happening in politics right now, are they going to play out when people actually put the ballot to what it is that they're thinking?
You teed up Rana's short perfectly.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that, because I am short Donald Trump. For the very reasons you mentioned, I mean, I think that all the play that he's getting for being leading the Republican polls by such a large margin is really interesting, because when you look at polls, they often don't reflect what voters do on a longer term basis, certainly not in a general at this stage. But what I think is interesting is, think about what happens when Trump makes some sort of crazy statement, right? He gets blanket press coverage. That's what reaches people at home. That's what gets the people that are really paying attention, deeply paying attention, at this point to the election cycle, excited. And I think that that plays to the kind of base that he has. But I'm not at all convinced that that's going to hold up in the primary season, and certainly not in a general.
But you could have probably said that to every statement in the past 6 months. And yet,
I can't help but think of The Onion had a headline this week. This will be the end of Trump's campaign, says increasingly nervous man, for the seventh time this year.
Yeah, but if you think about it, what has happened each time? People don't really start paying attention seriously to an election until probably the spring, to be honest. And right now, it's about outrageous statements, blanket news coverage, and that's what gets attention. And I think that that's why you see him climbing. By the way, I just want to mention, Gallup last year did a poll asking Republicans their most admired political figure, and guess what the majority of them said? Barack Obama. Bush,
whoa.
Yeah, Jeb Bush, in the entire political spectrum, 8%, that was the highest level, said Obama. I think 3% said Jeb Bush. So, you know, I mean, what do polls tell you? I don't know.
Okay, Dave, turning a little bit from, I guess, what, politics and economic policy to the intricacies of running a company, what are you short?
Okay, so you may remember about a year ago, maybe a little bit more, Zappos, the company that sells shoes, delivers them online, decided to go bossless. So it is a bossless
right.
company. This is called the Holacracy. And this is the move. This is the managerial move that launched 1,000 think pieces. So I read somewhere this week, somebody had tallied all of these things under the headline, okay, we get it. The Washington Post this past Sunday, New Republic before that, Today.com, our friends at NPR, The Atlantic ran a story, Our Boss is Necessary, a Radical Experiment at Zappos. So I am short on stories about a bossless workplace.
But are you short a bossless workplace itself?
No, just the coverage of it.
I am actually long a bossless workplace, and I'll tell you why. I just finished writing a big profile of Travis Kalanick, the head of Uber, who was on our shortlist for Time's Person of the Year. And one of the things that Uber plays to is the fact that everybody wants to be their own boss. Nobody wants to work in a company anymore, and I think that that's one of the fascinating things about that story. Almost all millennials will say, I want to work for myself. Now, once they get out and do that, you know, for 5 years, we'll see. But that's the hope.
I don't know, man. I kind of like hierarchy. Maybe I'm just super old-fashioned. Or maybe that's because I'm the host.
Tall as the new flat.
There's an earlier story in The Atlantic called The Secret Suffering of the Middle Manager, and I can't help if these two things are related.
Absolutely. Dave Shaw and Rana Fruhar, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Our stories are often dominated by numbers. It's kind of the nature of money. And here at Marketplace, our By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them every day on marketplace.org. Here are producers Tobin Lowe and Raghu Manavalan with some of this week's news by the numbers. Raghu.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
600.
That's the percentage sales rose for a body armor company just one day after the attacks in San Bernardino.
That company is called Security Pro USA. They make products like bulletproof backpacks and vests.
Many companies selling similar products say they have also noticed more civilians purchasing equipment after recent attacks.
100,000.
That's how many signatures are required in the UK for a petition to be considered by the British Parliament.
And right now, a petition to ban Donald Trump from entering the UK has at least 400,000 signatures.
The petition cites laws regarding hate speech as grounds for banning Trump.
16.
That's how many text messages were used in a study of how we perceive personality based on texts.
Binghamton students were asked to react to a variety of text messages that ranged from questions to one-word answers.
All right, Tobin, what did they find?
They found that if you end your text with a period, people think you're insincere. Did you hear that, Raghu?
Hold on. I'm texting you my response. OMG, Tobin, comma, that story is super interesting, period.
It's been a month since the terrorist attacks in Paris that killed 130 people. And last week, when Molly Wood was hosting this show, I was in Paris. I noticed people staying home, cops on the street with machine guns, and a palpable sense of anxiety. That was particularly true in a place called La Courneuve. It's a suburb where many immigrant families live in government housing projects. 10 years ago, people rioted here over what they saw as France's failure to incorporate Muslims and immigrants into society. It's a tension you can still feel in the neighborhood today, even as it starts to gentrify. I went to La Courneuve to meet with Monty Laster, an American artist who works with kids in the neighborhood, and to get a sense of what it's like to grow up there today.
Well, it's a war zone. I mean, it looks like what you see when you look at, when you look on CNN or all the big media.
Laster is a former missionary who moved to France 20 years ago. When he came to La Courneuve in 1999, he founded a nonprofit called FACE, the French-American Creative Exchange. It sponsors artistic and cultural projects in the neighborhood. Laster and I walked through a courtyard, past two burned-out cars, a giant pile of trash, and an abandoned building about to be demolished.
What's amazing to me is that right next door is the elementary school where I work with kids. I have an extension of my studio inside the school because I was able to get one of the classrooms that was abandoned to be able to have a studio inside the school, and I've done that now for more than 10 years. And the kids, this is where the kids have to go through in order to get to school every day.
Many of those kids have worked with Monty Laster doing photography, poetry, rap, and guided walks. Right now, FACE is building an interactive map of La Courneuve. And Laster has become something of a cheerleader for the neighborhood.
I got rid of everything in my studio and decided that I wanted to make it all about a place, instead of being a place of isolation, for me to work on a personal work, would be a place for people to come together from the local neighborhood, but also from outside of the neighborhood, so that there's was a free flow of energy as well from inside and outside, because that's the most important thing I think that's needed here.
Laster's studio is inside an 11th century water mill, which still stands near the public housing projects.
So we're going to go now inside the mill. If we don't mind just kind of scooping under, it's okay.
I spoke with six teenagers there who work with FACE. They were getting ready for a big community meeting between all the local nonprofits. And like many people in the neighborhood, they're largely of North African descent.
My name is Ibrahim Djoara. I have 11 years old. Chauf moi.
Pas 11.
No. 17 years old. But he's not 11.
My name is Issam Jay. I'm 17 years old.
Issam, whose family is from Marrakesh, says it was hard being perceived as not really French by some people, something many of the kids were worried about after the attacks. A recent study by the Montaigne Institute showed that Muslim men in France are more than four times less likely to get a job interview than their Catholic counterparts. Add to that a national unemployment rate of 10.6% and a 24.7% unemployment rate for young people. And it's tough for these teenagers to imagine what their futures will be.
With everything that's happened, it's going to make it even more difficult to this idea of social insertion, being able to be part of the economic culture here. And it's already not in great shape as it is, so it doesn't look very positive.
La Courneuve is adjacent to Saint-Denis, the suburb French police raided to find some of the Paris attackers. Since then, Issam says, police have come through his neighborhood frequently, and that's made some of the people who live here distrustful and angry.
It preoccupies, or even I think provokes, hatred among people, because really the police often do searches for no reason. Families have their lives upended because the police search through a whole house when there's nothing there.
The boys also worried about the Front National. That's the far-right party led by Marine Le Pen that's gained ground in regional elections.
It's a melting pot. You have to live with people even if you're against them. But the system gets us again. We're tiny compared to the system. And the Front National, with regard to all of that, they're gaining ground with everything that's happening. People who are, well, we won't say anti-Muslim, but people who aren't Muslims or people of color, I don't think it's just Muslims. It's people of color or anything. Arab, black. It's going to be very difficult to get through. With everything that's happening, they're gaining more and more ground because the French, the real French of old French origin, will say, actually, they're right, the Front National. We let them in, we make a place for them, and they take everything from us. So the outlook is pretty hard to see. It's going to be difficult now. You have to pay attention to even the slightest gesture you make.
His friend Ibrahim Djoara, who is also 17, said since the attacks, people look at him differently.
We don't look like guilty people, but with everything going on, they mistrust us. Not everyone, but, I mean, we see it.
Still, the boys said they want to be a part of a multicultural France. Here's Issam again.
Because we also want that. To the contrary, we want to mix. We like mixing. But when it's rejected, we won't force it, nor will we bother or harass them, burn cars, or do other stupid stuff that will aggravate the situation or provoke more hate. People are already in a bad spot. Why make our image even worse?
But they're afraid that right now, as much as they want France, France might not want them. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. And of course, also the host of the Codebreaker podcast. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So you brought us kind of a special director's cut from Codebreaker. Tell me about that. We're talking about high-frequency trading, which is one of those little understood things.
Yes, and even still little understood by me. Lizzie, you'd be amazed at how hard it is to answer the question of what is high-frequency trading, or HFT, as it's called in the business, right? The number of times I and our Codebreaker producer, Claire Tennisgetter, tried to work out an analogy with, like, oranges and different fruit markets would, yes, probably bore you. But simply defined, high-frequency trading is this idea of using computers, and more specifically, really powerful computer programs or algorithms that try to make pennies or fractions of pennies on trades at high volume and high speed. Right.
Yeah. And there are non-controversial ways that HFT is used, but controversy is kind of one of the big things about it. Some people in finance think it's kind of gaming the system.
Yeah, exactly. And this next story is about one of those people. This guy's name is Brad Katsuyama. You'll recognize it if you read Michael Lewis's book, Flash Boys.
Yep.
He used to work at the Royal Bank of Canada. Now he's got this new company called IEX. It is an alternative stock exchange. It's also called the dark pool. And it's taken a pretty unique approach to fight against the high-frequency trading that Katsuyama and others think is bad for the market. So here's the story that we did about it. Have you ever heard the phrase ghost in the machine? It comes from a decades-old philosophical debate about whether the mind is truly separate from the body. But it's also been used to describe something that was observed by Brad Katsuyama right before the financial crisis of 2008. Katsuyama was working at the Royal Bank of Canada, and he noticed that whenever he made an order on behalf of that bank for thousands of shares of a company, they would disappear and then reappear at a higher price. Katsuyama was noticing something that by now has been well documented: high-frequency trading. In this case, the use of super fast algorithms to make pennies on trades over and over and over and over again. Now, Katsuyama is in a massive glass building right next to One World Trade Center in the heart of New York City's financial district, which is where we found him. He says this kind of high-frequency trading is part of a practice that's been around for a long time.
People have been looking to game the stock market since the stock market opened hundreds of years ago. Of course people are going to be writing computer programs to game the stock market. I mean, it's just, it's obvious.
Without getting neck deep in the details, what he was watching at the time could sort of be described this way. A trader makes an order for stock at a certain price, but before that order gets fulfilled, super fast computer programs see the order, go buy that stock up, and then put it back on the market for a slightly higher price. This move annoyed Katsuyama.
Technology had dramatically changed the way that the stock market worked, like it has in every other industry out there, except it started to become a game of haves and have-nots.
This is happening at light speed, and we're talking literally in some cases because big financial institutions are paying for fiber optic cables and real estate that is geographically closer to the stock exchange's own servers. And regular traders, even big-time traders, can't compete with the high-frequency trading algorithms designed to beat them.
To give you some context, 300 milliseconds to blink your eye, and we're talking about microseconds, so very, very granular amounts of time.
So 2 years ago, Katsuyama and his new company, IEX, set out to do something interesting. They decided to start fighting against the decisive machines. IEX is an alternative trading system, also known as a dark pool. Katsuyama wants it to be a full exchange, and he wants it to be a fair exchange. And the way he's trying to do this is by slowing down the machines just enough that they can't pull this kind of sneaky move, this so-called electronic front-running. Basically, he's making everyone wait a little longer in front of IEX's front door when they want to buy stock in his system. Here's the weird part. He does this by literally coiling 38 miles of a fiber optic internet cable around and around so that it takes longer for orders to come in, almost like engineering a data traffic jam or slowdown so these certain high-frequency trading algorithms can't get an edge over regular traders.
Even if someone gets information before IEX gets it, when they try to send an order to IEX to act on it, to pick someone off or to scalp somebody, it has to travel around that coiled cable. And as it's traveling around the coiled cable, IEX is fast enough to get the update in time to ensure that every trade on IEX is being priced in a consistently fair way.
All of this is happening so fast. Are you ready? I'm going to play you a sound for 300 milliseconds, that blink of an eye thing Katsuyama was talking about. Okay, now I'm going to play you a sound that is long enough that it represents the time it takes for an order to travel Katsuyama's 38-mile cable. 350 microseconds. Ready? The sound is so short, it can't even generate an actual tone or note. All you hear is a click. The people at IEX say a slowdown of this amount of time, just barely discernible to the human ear, this click could make markets both safer and more fair, more based on decisions the humans make about companies, instead of sneaky, decisive algorithms designed to skim money off the top of an order before the orderer even sees what hit him.
You say you're fighting the system. Can you win?
I think we can win. I think it'll largely be up to the industry to determine whether we win or not. Take any age-old gaming technique for the stock market, whether it's spoofing, showing false demand and trying to influence the stock, whether it's, you know, an electronic front-running technique to try to like pick up signals and race. All of that's completely unproductive. And before it used to be done manually, and now it's done by computers. And that's the kind of thing that we need to live without.
So I listen to that and hear him say that's the thing we need to live without.
Yeah.
But HFT is profitable. And when he says it's up to the industry, why would certain players in the industry move against something that makes them money?
So I think that he would make this distinction, right, between using HFT just to make quick trades on decisions that you're making about a certain company or sort of watching the way that the market works and not really trying to skip the line, as it were. And like, I think that he makes this distinction between using high frequency trading for just making trading happen fast on the market, which is what everyone wants to do, right? And actually trying to use it to do a kind of end run around the company or the person that's trying to make a order for stock.
Do you think that this type of self-regulation he's talking about is possible and likely?
I think that's the big question, right, Lizzie? He thinks that it is. He wants to believe that it is. He's constructed his business around this idea. And he does have some pretty big clients. So there are names that you would recognize from the finance industry that use IEX. And by the way, that company is IEX is currently in this application phase with the SEC to go from alternative trading system status to legitimate U.S. stock exchange. It's really unclear of whether that's actually ever going to happen. But that would make IEX compete with the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, and others that Brad, I think, would argue have, yes, some good trading happening and some totally natural sort of fundamental market things happening, but also some of this HFT that he doesn't believe is good for the system.
Bed Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and Codebreaker and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Now, I'm going to ask you for a little help. Marketplace Weekend is supported by listeners. And to help us keep telling relevant and interesting stories, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift, in any amount, counts twice as much right now, thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Please donate at marketplace.org by December 31st, and thank you very much. Being a pedestrian in North Carolina is pretty dangerous. Federal data shows that there are 2 pedestrian deaths per 100,000 people. That's the 6th worst in the country. And in one city, West Jefferson, the federal government stepped in with money and engineers to help. Our listeners told us about the story as part of our Local Money Project, where you tell us what's happening where you live. And we brought in Dan Vock from Governing Magazine to explain what happened in North Carolina. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
I want you to explain what was happening in North Carolina and in West Jefferson that got the federal government's attention.
Well, it actually was something that was going on in North Carolina generally. There was high rates of pedestrian deaths. And so the federal government came in and decided that they would offer training to state engineers to help them understand concepts that would make the streets safer for pedestrians, bicyclists, and other users of the road.
And it sounds like West Jefferson was sort of a laboratory for this. Can you tell me what they did?
Yeah, what happened was there was one man in particular, an engineer for the North Carolina Department of Transportation, who was basically tired of always having to fix the stoplight. They're very expensive in a rural area, and it takes a long time to get out there and get crews. And what he said was basically, if you put in a stop sign as opposed to a stop light, we'll give you some extra money to make the rest of the downtown look nice too, which would calm traffic, make it easier for pedestrians to walk around, to shop, for cyclists to get around. And so with that sort of deal, they decided to rip out the old stoplight and calm down the traffic in downtown, which made a big difference for just the feel of downtown.
It seems somewhat counterintuitive that, like, taking out a stoplight and putting in a stop sign would calm down traffic. How does that work?
Well, what happens is that, you know, this was a big sort of main road through downtown, which used to have big lumber trucks going through. So it's a very wide street. And, you know, if you've ever driven down a wide street, you just kind of want to go faster. If you go down narrower, you feel like you're a little bit more hemmed in and you want to slow down. Well, that isn't great if you want to zoom through town. But if you want to cross the street once you get out of your car, it's a lot safer and you feel a lot more comfortable. So the drivers naturally slow down and people feel more comfortable walking around.
That's so interesting. You know, the other thing that I thought about when I was reading the story you wrote about this is that this was about traffic and pedestrian safety, but it sounds like it sort of created an economic resurgence in West Jefferson, North Carolina.
Yeah, and this is actually something that's happening sort of around the country, and this is a good example of this complete streets idea, and that is when you start to slow down traffic and make the experience of the street more about walking around and enjoying the neighborhood, then, you know, you might want to stop and look at the window in a street. You know, there's, if you have wider sidewalks, which are there for safety reasons for pedestrians, it also makes it easier to, say, put out chairs and tables for a restaurant to eat outside when it's a nice day. And so, you know, people just feel more comfortable. They want to walk around a little bit more, sort of enjoy the space. And that's the type of atmosphere, you know, for a place like West Jefferson, they've got antique stores and art galleries and restaurants. You know, that's the type of business that really sort of pops up when you sort of take your time around downtown.
And Complete Streets is the name of this sort of planned philosophy. Why don't more places do this? It kind of seems like it would be a no-brainer.
Well, it is getting a lot more popular, especially you'll see it in big cities. But, you know, the idea that, as you mentioned, slowing down your car is a good thing, it really is sort of counterintuitive to how, you know, most Americans have grown up as sort of in this car culture.
Yeah.
So you have to sort of be able to lose your attachment to the car, at least in certain places. You know, sometimes this involves changing the parking spaces or putting in bike lanes or things, you know, when people really want sort of their space in the road. So it takes a little convincing. You almost have to see it actually work somewhere. And that's something that's happening in West Jefferson. A lot of towns that would have never thought about it before have seen it in West Jefferson and then decided, well, wait, we can do something like that. So you almost have to see it to believe it.
You wrote that the state gave West Jefferson $250,000 to do this. Is there money in other places to install similar plans?
I think that's really a case-by-case scenario. Again, in this case, the incentive was for the state. In North Carolina, the state owns most of the roads, including all the like little downtown strips through all these small towns. And so they were going to save money in the long term. So that's why they were able to sort of negotiate that deal. In other places, though, you know, cities are doing a lot of this when they have to rip up their streets anyway. You know, you have to repave a road. You might as well make it look nice while you do it. And so there are lots of opportunities, and they don't have to be huge improvements, but there's not always a big pot of money somewhere.
Dan Vock is a reporter for Governing. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Come tell us about the important economic stories where you live. Go to our website, marketplaceweekend.org, and click on Local Money. A sentient, breathing being, you're aware that the new Star Wars movie, The Force Awakens, comes out next week. We know all the main characters from the original trilogy are back. We know advanced ticket sales are through the roof, but we don't know all that much about the plot. However, in a very marketplacey move, one economist crunched the numbers and wrote a paper that The Force Awakens should be about a bailout. Yes, really. Our digital producer, Tony Wagner, has the story. Hi, Tony.
Hey, Lizzie.
Okay. An economist studied Star Wars and says, what? Tell me about this.
Right. So it's this guy, Zach Feinstein. He's an assistant professor at Washington University, and he studies the way that these things happen in the real world. And he's basically positing that the new Star Wars movie, based on what's come before, could very well start with the galaxy needing a huge bailout.
Unfortunately, I haven't been able to see Star Wars Episode 7 yet, but it's possible there was a financial crisis and the Rebel Alliance was not able to hold on to power due to that. Maybe this is the route that they decided to take. I doubt that will be the case, but if it is, I will be the one person that has truly studied this and said, that makes sense.
Okay, all right. So if the movie is about bailouts, sure, he's on the money then. Back up. Why are we talking about all of this?
Lizzie, you and I both know, of course, at the end of 1983's Star Wars Return of the Jedi, Lando Calrissian and the Rebels blew up the Death Star, and Darth Vader killed the evil Emperor before dying himself. And, of course, we both know the Death Star is a moon-sized space station super weapon that can destroy planets.
Yeah, that's not a planet. That's a space station.
Exactly. And there were two of them, and the first one, Luke Skywalker, blew up in 1977's original Star Wars. Basically, he's looking at what would have happened in the galaxy if you kill a head of state, the only head of state in this empire, and also blow up two government projects worth quintillions of dollars apiece.
I'm sorry, quintillions?
Right, yeah. So to figure all this out, Feinstein had to find real-world examples to try to figure out what it might cost to build a Death Star, or two of them.
In the end, the Death Star is a very large aircraft carrier. I just took the cost of the USS Gerald Ford, which was $17.5 billion, and scaling it up based on the cost of the steel that would be necessary for the Death Star.
So using that calculation, he then sort of expanded it out to try to figure out what the entire galactic economy would have been by comparing it to the Manhattan Project in the 40s. What it shook out to is that two Death Stars are going to run you about $600 quintillion to build. So, you know, pocket change to you and me. And the GGP, that's gross galactic product, was something like $6 sextillion when the second Death Star blew up.
I'm having a hard time keeping a straight face here in the studio. Clearly, you had fun talking about this. It's fascinating to me because I've seen The Empire Strikes Back more than 30 times.
Wow.
But what are we supposed to think of all of this if you're trying to compare it to the real world?
Yeah, so the basic conclusion is that it would have taken at least $900 quintillion to keep the galaxy at recession levels and losing like 1% of GGP. And it's important that he pulled out real world examples for this. I mean, this is what Feinstein studies at Washington University. Is he took, you know, the way that markets responded after disasters during the housing crisis. So kind of spinning that out and using these models, you can start to see that there's some real world parallels here.
So if I'm a bank, I owe you money, you owe me money. But if I go into default because someone blew up the Death Star, I'm now not able to pay you what I owe. But you were counting on that money to be able to pay off someone else. So the loss from one bank can spread and amplify through the system. So we saw this in 2008. This is why we really needed to bail out the banks. Because if we didn't, it would spread to otherwise healthy banks and otherwise healthy companies.
So, yeah, Feinstein even identified this bank in the Star Wars universe, the International Banking Clan. It's kind of the Empire's Lehman Brothers, and under his models, it goes under.
Tony Wagner, thank you for somehow turning your hobby into a story.
It was a real pleasure. Anytime.
In the high season of sports right now. The NFL is getting close to the playoffs. The NBA and the NHL are in full swing. We even got a lot of baseball trade news from the MLB's winter meetings. And meetings like that really underline that professional sports is, of course, a multi-million dollar business. But a lot of leagues are also in the habit of partnering with different charities. And we wanted to know, when they do that, who really benefits? So we brought in Lee Eagle. He's the director of NYU's Sports and Society program. Welcome back.
Hi, great to be here.
A lot of people watch football games on the weekend, Monday nights, etc. I am admittedly a bit jaded about the kind of roll call of NFL issues I could tick through right now. But you might see, if you're watching a telecast, a lot of sort of charitable causes, things they're raising money for. Do we know how much money they're raising when they do these kind of promotions?
Well, we have an idea of how much money is being raised when there are promotions between sports teams and leagues and charitable causes, nonprofit organizations, non-governmental organizations.
We see pink on the field for breast cancer awareness, for example.
Sure, with the NFL.
October, yeah.
Yep.
So what kind of bucks are we talking about?
Certainly into the millions. Certainly into the millions, and then and that's just with the direct programming. Anything that comes after that, you know, in terms of if it gets somebody into the idea of wanting to join sort of a race for the cure or something like this, then we're, you know, certainly getting into the billions of dollars.
Can we chart the course of a dollar, say, that goes through one of these programs?
Certainly we could. An economist would love to chart the course of a dollar, but a behaviorist,
yes,
would really look at, we'd want to know why, yes, why is this happening? And what are people thinking about when they're actually making the purchase for something like a Race for the Cure, or, you know, they want to buy the pink T-shirt or a pink hat? That's not to pick on the NFL, but let's take that as an example. And we could chart that, the course of that money, and watch it get split up a number of different ways, which is understandable. But really the question is, what is it that the people who are making that purchase getting out of the deal?
Well, let's think about a recent example that we know from the government. The Department of Defense spent $53 million for big patriotic displays, pro-veteran signage, advertising to the NFL, other leagues, other teams. Who is profiting from that? Is it the DOD that profits, or is it the NFL aligning themselves with, I guess for lack of a better word, commercial patriotism?
The answer is both, hopefully, because that's really what this is about. If we can drop down into business speak, and it's really about strategic partnerships and win-win kind of situations. And, of course, the Department of Defense in that case is hoping to get more people recruited.
Right.
And the NFL, in this case, wants to look pretty good to the public, that it cares about troops in the military. And that's where things start to open up, and we can really begin to look and see who's getting what out of it. Are they getting out of the deal what it is that they want?
When you think about different professional sports leagues, do some do this better than others?
Really, the thing to look at is where values line up.
Hmm.
This is really a value proposition and a values proposition. So if there's something that looks like it aligns to people between the two organizations, then it works. But if it doesn't, if it just feels like it doesn't and it doesn't work, you can look at something like with the Department of Defense and the NFL, everybody at the game and watching on television assumed, and this is really where things start to get interesting, is that the NFL was interested in promoting the military. And the military was happy to do it. When people found out that the military was paying the NFL millions of dollars to do that,
$53 million, that's a lot of money.
Values start going off in different directions. Mm. And while we're piling onto the NFL, same thing happened with the Susan G. Komen Foundation and the NFL a number of years ago, and where money was going and how it was being spent. It's not a question of guilt or innocence. These are enterprises, and they're in business in part to do a public good. And that's really, by the way, where something interesting happens, because when those programs align, people feel really good.
Give me an example of where those programs have aligned and succeeded.
The NHL has a program. It's a green initiative. And that one seems to really have hit because they're able to go into the facilities and really promote sort of green programming and how environmentally friendly those things are. And that's something that connects because you're in the facility. You can see that it's responsible in that way. That's different than a program that doesn't seem to have any sort of alignment. And where people go, I don't get it. Why are they doing this thing or that thing? That's really where you can start to see things work. And by the way, this is all about consumption. Remember Lance Armstrong?
Yes.
Day, those yellow bracelets. The questions that you're asking really are about consumption. And it's consumption as a pathway to participation. And participation builds social capital. That's what we'd like to call it. And so you feel good about this, right? You can align yourself with a football team or soccer team, what have you, and a really good cause. And when those things connect, it feels pretty good, and it works.
Lee Eagle, co-director of NYU Sports and Society, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, we want to know, what's the worst gift you've ever given or gotten? Tell us about it. Visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament, Haley Hirschman, and Raghu Manavalan. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Chris Clark and Daniel Ramirez are our engineers. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.